And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
If you listen to the news these days, then you pretty much have to believe that the Earth is in for some difficult times ahead. Already, we have too many people who are using too much of the Earth's resources, and now we're faced with billions and billions of newly enfranchised consumers who are going to exponentially increase the problem. Our oceans are fished out, our glaciers are melting, there's political instability resulting from too much poverty, and someone thinks they have an answer to all of this? Someone does. And that someone is Lester Brown, and he's come up with a plan. Plan B2. Will it work? We report. You decide. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
John Lennon said, "We all want to change the world." And it sure is time for a change. As a matter of fact, depending on who you're listening to, we'd better start pretty fast. Today, I'm going to bring you a lot of useful information on a real plan to change the world. It's written by one of the world's most distinguished environmentalists, Lester Brown, who heads the Earth Policy Institute. His book and plan is entitled Plan B2. It's getting a lot of attention from leaders around the world who see, perhaps, a unified strategy to move forward together in a world united. Following the news, we'll be talking with Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute, Janet Larson, who's been traveling around the world along with Lester Brown, and we'll discuss the various aspects of Plan B2. We dedicate the entire show to Plan B2, we start out in Segment 1, discussing the problems. Then in Segment 2, we begin to explore the nature of change. And in Segment 3, we get specific. Perhaps one of the most important factoids that you'll learn from this show is that the entire annual budget to completely implement Plan B2 is a paltry $161 billion a year. I'll repeat that. For $161 billion a year, we can accomplish a miraculous agenda of positive change on this planet. Sound pretty good? Don't take this one lightly. There's some great ideas that will be discussed in this show. Take the time to listen. You'll be informed. You'll know what's happening. That's important. So, because if we do, we can all begin to change the world. Following the news. So now, the news. House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi announced that she is spearheading an effort to create a special committee on global warming as a pillar of the new Democratic Congress. The ongoing committee would dedicate significant time to address the issues of global warming and could become one of the most visible panels to explore the issue. This special committee is expected to be headed by Democratic Congressman Edward Markey of Massachusetts. Congressman Markey is in favor of raising the mileage standard of American cars and is one of the most vocal critics of oil companies and automakers. The Global Warming Committee, by its nature, shakes up the usual power structure of the House, as the issue is generally considered to fall under the purview of the Energy and Commerce Committee and the Ways and Means Committee. Pelosi's effort is her way of trying to force the issue of global warming onto the front burner of the Bush administration. The Zoological Society of London has identified 10 edge species, which it plans to focus attention on in the year ahead. Edge species are a strange breed of species which are both evolutionarily unique and globally endangered. What this means is that if they were to become extinct, there would be no similar species that would replace them. The list includes some very unusual creatures, including the Bactrian camel, the pygmy hippopotamus, the slender loris, which is a very small primate that can cling to a thumb and is noticeable by its gigantic eyes, and the bumblebee bat, possibly the world's smallest mammal. The Society will be placing its focus on these 10, which are a portion of the 100 of which the Society will work to protect in the years ahead. To learn more, visit edgeofexistence.org. Wildlife authorities in Australia are puzzled as to the cause of over 5,000 birds that have dropped dead out of the skies in Western Australia since December. At this point, the cause of this strange occurrence is not clearly understood, as it is not limited to any one species and seems unique to nectar and insect-eating birds. Authorities are investigating the deaths with the hopes of finding out if perhaps the cause is from an environmental toxin, such as an agricultural or industrial toxin. Bird flu, or H5N1, has been ruled out. Meanwhile, in Austin, Texas, earlier this week, a portion of the town was shut down while authorities investigated the death of 63 birds in the downtown area. The area remains off limits until lab reports are in to determine the cause of the deaths. And Wednesday, leaders of the evangelical and scientific communities announced a joint effort to protect the global environment and advance policies that address some of the most pressing threats to our planet, including global warming, habitat destruction, and species extinction. The effort is being spearheaded by the National Association of Evangelicals and Scientists at the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. And that's the news. And a few announcements. Got a hot tip? Send it to the Wild Side News at wildsidenews@cox.net. Next week, we talk with world-renowned nature photographer Jeff Mitchum. So now, on to today's in-depth look at Plan B2. Every week on the Wild Side News, we try to cover another aspect of the relationship of nature and the environment and people and cultures, because we are facing challenges now that we really have never faced before, particularly not in our lifetimes. I'm sure human societies throughout all time have faced extraordinary challenges, but we face a challenge which is unique to our time. Part of the challenge that we have is the fact that there are so many different groups and organizations who are trying to find answers and offer suggestions and are working hard and working with their membership to get people to write their Congress people and make a difference. But unfortunately, sometimes it's difficult to see the big picture. Really, how does this all fit together? Well, there is someone who's been working on that primarily all of his life, and that is the legendary ecologist and environmentalist Lester Brown, who at this time is traveling around the world trying to do everything he can to get the world to realize, number one, that we are in difficult times, and two, that there's a limited amount of time to act before perhaps we go into levels of crisis that could seriously impact literally life on Earth. So to talk about a new book that he has, which is called Plan B 2.0, now joining us from Washington, D.C., and the Earth Policy Institute is Janet Larson, who's the Director of Research for Earth Policy Institute and works with Lester Brown directly. Janet, I want to welcome you to the Wild Side News.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Janet, why don't you give a little background on Lester Brown, because we could literally spend the entire show almost documenting everything that he's done, but you probably have a way of saying it in a more succinct way than I would.
Certainly. Lester Brown, now the president and founder of the Earth Policy Institute, which is an environmental research organization in Washington, D.C., is perhaps best known for founding the World Watch Institute back in the mid-1970s. He transitioned into the nonprofit environmental research world, actually got his start as a farmer, a tomato farmer in southern New Jersey, working with the land directly. And he attributes his interest in the global environmental system and the global economy partly to his opportunity to travel to India back in the 1950s as a young man. He lived in villages, rural villages in India, got to see how people lived, got to see life outside of tomato farms in New Jersey, and realized that if he really wanted to make a difference in the world, he didn't want to live his whole life as a farmer, but really think about the connections between agriculture, poverty society and how we can really move towards a more positive future.
Then he also got involved in governmental work, working as an advisor to any number of different politicians and think tanks and things.
His first job was at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and worked with their international policy. And there, while he was at the Department of Agriculture, he, in his spare time, wrote his first book on land, man, and food, and went on moving up the agriculture system and was an advisor to Orville Friedman, the Secretary of Agriculture, back in 1964.
And since that time, because of his work, which now is a very personal mission, he's received many, many different recognitions, including becoming a MacArthur Fellow, which I'm still waiting for them to call me. I haven't received that call yet, but he had the honor of becoming a MacArthur Fellow, which is one of the highest accolades for service available on the planet today. Well, Janet, let's start talking about Plan B 2.0. It begs the question, first of all, why do we call this Plan B?
Plan B. Plan B is so titled because we realize that right now, the world business as usual, what we term Plan A, isn't working. And thus, we need an alternative. And when what you're doing isn't working, what do you move to? Plan B. So we wanted to not only add to the number of voices that right now are talking about all the world's problems, but really present a positive plan for the future on how we can reshape our society and our economies to really improve human condition and what we call in the subtitle, Rescue a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble.
Plan A is most exemplified right now in a process of economic globalization. And I think that that really begins to speak to some of the challenges that Lester Brown is beginning to address, and that is economically, the economic systems that are in place and are projected to continue in place simply aren't a model that work.
I agree. I think that is a big premise of the book. And one thing that we've looked at that really tells the story succinctly is looking at China, and China, a country of 1.4 billion people, has now replaced the United States as the leading consumer of a number of resources: grain, meat, coal, steel, fertilizer, cellular phones, television sets, refrigerators. And, you know, for years and years and years, you could safely say, well, the U.S., you know, with such a small share of the world's population, is the number one consumer. But that's no longer true. China now beats us out. They eat about twice as much meat as we do in the United States. They use more coal, steel, fertilizer. And so that sort of begs the next question. Right now, China's annual income per person is about $5,300. How long will it take them to reach the U.S. figure where annual income per person is closer to $38,000?
Mm-hmm.
And right now, China's growing its economy at close to 10% each year. So in theory, if they continue that rapid growth, they could reach U.S. income levels by 2031, and then they'll have 1.45 billion people. And so at that point, then what happens to their resource use? Well, if they consume coal like we do in the U.S. at nearly 2 tons per person, it would take China 2.8 billion tons of coal, more than the world currently uses. Or if China decides to drive around like we do in the United States right now in the U.S., there's 3 automobiles for every 4 people. Clearly, if China were to do that, it would expend the entire world's automobile fleet. And with oil, right now oil is one of the few resources where China has not caught up to the United States. But it were China's current consumption of about 7-8 million barrels per day come close to the U.S. use of 20 million barrels of oil per day, well, then they would need about 100 million barrels of oil per day, and that the world is currently producing only close to 80.
What the premise of the book says is that we're really reaching many, many limits. Certainly people hear about peak oil all the time, and we're sort of trying to figure out what that means. We've witnessed some of the consequences of reaching peak oil as oil went above $70 a barrel, and that was kind of a bit of a wake-up call. But there's other peaks, and as a matter of fact, we're beginning to see declines in other areas. And one of the things that Lester Brown really does is his book is so extremely well documented with the fact after fact and details and numbers and statistics that if a person reads the book, they can't help but come out realizing that, number one, these things are truly occurring, and that he makes the case that we're really facing, we have a timeline here, we have a time crunch that we cannot go on forever. What I'd like to do next is to start going through the areas that he truly defines as the most critical areas where we're running into, or our civilization is in trouble. And we might start out with the concept, we've already kind of talked about oil, but if you'd like to talk about oil, I'd also like to talk about water and global warming. Why don't you talk about some of the concepts that Lester wants us to understand at this point?
I think water is a really fascinating story. Just in the last 50 years, world water use tripled, partly because we have these new pumps that are powered by energy, be it diesel fuel or other around the world, that can drill deeper and deeper to reach our underground water sources.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that, of course, we look at with water is water used for food production. Of all the world water the world uses, about 70% of it goes to agricultural production. So what Lester Brown wanted to examine is what happens when countries like India, like China, are drilling more and more wells to reach these finite underground water supplies. And what we see is that water tables are falling in the world's major food producing areas. In China, it's the North China Plain where they produce much of their grain. In India, it's the Punjab, India's breadbasket. And in these locations, we're seeing water tables fall down deeper and deeper as wells drill more and more water. And it's true, too, in the United States, in the Great Plains and our Ogallala Aquifer, which is largely a fossil aquifer, meaning this underground water source that is not naturally replenished. Farmers are drilling more and more wells to get that water, and you can see it very, very clearly if you fly from coast to coast in the United States, and as you go over the Great Plains and the Midwest, you often see these green circles, mm-hmm. bright green circles in otherwise brown squares of land, and those green circles are the crops being irrigated by a center pivot irrigation system, and that water is coming from underground to grow those green crops.
Right, and as a result of that, in some parts of the world, as water is becoming less available, people are migrating to cities, for example, in China and other places. Water is the most critical element in terms of just our survival for food and literally our survival. So we're reaching a point around the world where water is becoming a critical issue. And what we're going to do is kind of go through some of these things and then start to talk about the ways in which Lester Brown is suggesting that we begin to look at this. So that's the challenge. How does Plan B propose to turn this all around? We continue our in-depth feature with the Earth Policy Institute following this short but very important message.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.